Good evening, everybody. James McKinney with my Science Hour for August 25th, 2022, in the ongoing series, year-long series of the discoveries of my work, the history of the discoveries. And once again, this is not related to my actual work. This is the history of the discoveries. So you have to read my books, do the education package, which is extensive, and listen to other past radio shows, etc. So this is the history. Okay, so last week I left off, I was talking about the Atlantis to Tesla book, and there were a few follow-up topics, I should say the whole title, Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection. And this was a monumental book in history because it introduced the Colburn. The whole issue that there were books left over from the time of Christ that had not been altered, and that is the big issue. And then drawing the connection between ancient civilizations that were advanced using atmospheric electricity and Tesla. So these are huge, absolutely huge topics. And then also in the appendix, let me just go to the table of contents here to wrap up the placing this book into context. I start this book out by reviewing the previous books, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes and the Surviving Planet X Passage books. And I do that to put this book into perspective relative to the previous books. And I did that up until the Diamond Principle. And that's why sometimes I tell people, they say, well, I just want to read a book and get an overall feeling for your work. And so I tell them, read the Diamond Principle. That's a book that we'll be talking about here. That came later in the series. But it goes through all of the previous books, putting them into perspective, and then goes into the book, The Diamond Principle. And then the Atlantis to Tesla book is based again on the whole idea of the electricity in the solar system, in the universe, and the physics, and then putting it into perspective that Atlantis, before the fall, was one of the chapters, the world that was, I talk about the world before the antediluvian world, the anti-Atlantis fall world, and then the beginning of the end, these are chapters, the night the world died, the great flood, I talk about that, rising out of the ashes, the next 1,000 years, the Colburn, a link to the past, secret societies. This is where this broke this whole topic open, wide open for the public. This is something that really had not been discussed previously, only in small circles, certainly was not a common household word. This made the term secret societies a household word. And then I talk about the rise of modern science and then Tesla. And I call the 20th century, 1900 to 2000, I call it the Black Century because it really was a form of dark ages with two world wars, many hundreds of other wars, and then just the science, the way it was developed, and then the space age, which had remarkable machinery but terrible science. And then, of course, the chapter, Will Man Survive? But at the very end of the book, I have a chapter, Electric Highways to the Stars, and that is the title of my talk at the 2004 UFO Congress, where this book was released. And I've already talked about the story where I had my conference, and then afterwards there was a book signing out in the main hall of the event, and there were probably, I'd say, 1,500 people in the audience. Between 1,200 and 1,500 was the amount, the number of people, a huge event. And the name of my talk was Electric Highways to the Stars, which was attended by many Tier 1 scientists in the crowd there. So that was very interesting, and I talked about that before. The man who waited until everybody was gone turned out to be a physicist on a nuclear submarine. And then at the end of the paper, I have a couple papers that I have talked about before, Dynamics of a Small Comet, then the next chapter, Currents Induced by Foreign Objects in Non-Uniform Plasmas. And I went through those papers previously. I've talked about those. So I'm just going to put this into perspective that those were papers from the 1980s, and they are now in the appendix of this book. And then cosmic rays from the sun. My discovery that the sun had put out big flares of cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are relativistic protons. And previously, cosmic rays were only believed to have come from supernova and from the hearts of galaxies, etc. And what this showed conclusively with evidence was that the cosmic rays were being produced by our very own sun, something that nobody ever imagined. And when I produced that and publicized it and then sent the information to NASA, they literally said, you cannot make any discoveries with NASA. The only discoveries can be made by NASA scientists. That's the level of corruption it had gotten to. And these scientists were monitoring, these were scientists on the SOHO project, the Solar Observatory Project, which is a satellite that observes the sun 24/7 and had been for years. And I saw the cosmic rays come into the sensors. I published the material. And NASA goes, only our scientists can discover things like this. You cannot discover things like this. And absolutely, just outright corruption within the scientific community. And of course, these are tier two scientists also. But the Atlantis to Tesla book, once again, a pivotal book in history, very important book. And when you read it, a lot of people read this a couple times because of its importance. Okay, so that gets us to the weather book. And I call it the weather book. That's a simpler name than the real name. The real name is Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. And books that are called Principia historically have been very pivotal books, like the Isaac Newton, the Principia Mathematica, many concepts delivered in that book. So the weather book, Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, it's kind of a hard thing to say, but the physics of Sun-Earth Weather. So what is that connection between the sun and Earth? And of course, the NASA scientists had been laboring over this for decades. There are now satellites up monitoring the sun, and they totally missed the entire point because they're dealing what are known as Chapman physics. Now, I've already talked a little bit about this a couple shows ago in earlier August show. I think it was August 4th. To put this into perspective, I talk about the weather of all the planets, something that really nobody had done before. And I discover things in this book. I present discoveries that, for example, with a solar flare, it's not necessarily the intensity of the solar flare, but the rapid change of the flare. And so that's something that other scientists had never understood that. How fast does a solar flare hit? It's kind of like the impulse factor on solar flaring. But there is so much material here, and I had so many years of data collection that this book actually turned out to be around 600 pages in its original form. And that was just absolutely outrageous. It would be impossible for me to publish this book. It would be so expensive that people could not purchase it. And even as it is, I believe it's like $70 for the print version now. The ebook version is available on my webpage and at a much lower cost, and also is included in the library. So if you buy a complete library called the Everything Library, which includes everything on the sales page, then the weather book in the ebook format is included. If you want it in the print version, you have to pay for the print version. And that's just because reprinting it would be a big issue. Okay, so I want to remind you that the education package reviews all of these books in detail. And so that's a whole different topic where I go topic by topic and review the science, talk about other extenuating circumstances and a lot of supportive material in the education program. And so all of these books have extensive coverage there. But putting this into historical perspective, nobody had understood weather in the solar system like I did. And so the first thing I do in this book is I review standard meteorological concepts, and NASA and NOAA, NASA, of course, is National Space Administration, and then NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And so this is what we call the National Weather Service. Oh my goodness, these people are so backwards and just retarded. They have no idea what causes weather. And just to give you an example, every year they give out a hurricane prediction. And it's based on lollipop and roses, rosy sunglasses. And what it is, they give a prediction on the number of storms, the number of named storms, and all of these different categories of storms they have. And they have kind of a standard number. There would be 13 named storms in the season, and if you have two more than that, that was a big prediction. But what they do is, because this is the hurricane season, it runs from June to November in the United States, mainly the East Coast and the South Coast of the U.S., and the Gulf of Mexico, where there's a potential for hurricanes to form and affect the areas, etc., or the Mexico also, Central America sometimes. But primarily, what they give is kind of like, let me give you an example. Say I predicted between now, which we're in August, for example, but say that back in June I would predict that there would be 200 days of sunny weather and 100 days of rainy weather. And we know historically that that's about the average number. But this year I go, this year there's going to be 220 days of nice weather and only 80 days of rainy weather. And then when you get to September, halfway through this prediction season, they make an adjustment, because then they can get closer. And then at the end they go, wow, we were right on target. When it's not a prediction at all. And what I did is I predicted weather, and to the day, and I've talked about this, the September 6th, 1999 prediction with Comet Lee, and everybody thought, McCanny is nuts. 2 days before, 1 day before, there's not a single weather event in the entire world, and I'm predicting massive hurricanes and devastating storms. At midnight on that date, the world just exploded with storms. Over 60 major storms around the Earth's equator at that time, with many, many hurricanes, hurricane-level storms, just out of nowhere. And as I said, the silence was deafening, because my prediction was so exact. So absolutely exact. And so the people backed off after that. They didn't know what to do, because I was making predictions months in advance. I made that prediction in the springtime, and then I confirmed it in May. So months in advance, I predicted a given day. And not only predicted it, but I said, what's going to cause this? And by the way, there's always people running around, jumping up and down, saying that there are gravitational alignments of the planets. And the literal interpretation in physics, real physics, is that the planets are weightless with respect to each other. They are literally weightless, as just like a astronaut orbiting the Earth in low Earth orbit is weightless. There are gravitational effects, but they're offset by the path that these astronauts are taking in space. It's a curved path. It's a circle around the Earth, and or an ellipse, whatever. And the gravitational force is offset by the centrifugal force, and so the net force is zero. So Earth is gravitationless with respect to all the other planets and the sun. There are tidal forces, and that's a different story. That's a third order gravitational force. And then I talked about the cover photo, where I predicted that there was a hurricane that was coming in and into Florida. And this hurricane could have hit with all of these school kids in class, etc. And the National Weather Service did not have an evacuation. How insane. And they were lucky because the hurricane turned and went offshore. But hurricane predictions are impossible to make, literally, in terms of where a particular hurricane is going to go. And so they dodged a bullet. I talk about that in the book. But what I do is I take apart standard meteorological concepts, and I say, for example, the sun light energy is not the source of our weather. It's not the energy source. It has nothing to do with our weather. In fact, if it were the only source of energy, we would have very bland weather. We would not have clouds, no lightning, no storms. We would not have hurricanes or wind. We would not have anything if it were not for the electrical component, which introduces a lot more energy. I talk about the goofiness of the so-called El Niño y La Niña effects, which are totally goofy. Anyway, I'm not going to go into those details here, but just standard meteorology is just so torqued. That's the best word I can use about it. And here's the problem. Once again, you have a scientific community that has very little physics background. Just like geologists, just like other branches where they make statements and there's no physics to back it up. It's just absolutely absurd that they're making claims, or like plate tectonics, that these plates, and every student will repeat it, oh, these plates just move around the globe, just like moving the mouse on your mouse pad. They just move around. You know, there has to be forces involved, and if there are forces, you have to identify the source of those forces, and it's not a plate subducting under the other. In a textbook, it looks wonderful. But in reality, when you examine the physics of that situation, it simply does not exist. So I'm just going to quick read through the chapters here. Of course, I talk about the cover photo, and then the electrical solar system weather. Here's where I go into the very serious aspect of understanding the electrical nature of weather. Then the sun-earth connection, the climate and global warming myths. Now, this is something that has just dominated life. People repeating it, global warming and we're all going to die, etc. And so I take this as a complete chapter and break it apart and give the real science that there is no such thing as global warming due to CO2. And of course, people don't talk about that because all they can say is global climate warming, and everybody jumps on the bandwagon. Action at a distance is a chapter, very important chapter. Hurricanes, tornadoes, and storms, weathers of the planets. So I go through all of the planets, and I talk about their weather. And then I talk about comets, the harbingers of doom, and talk about the real situation with comets. Then I talk about local electrical batteries. This is a huge topic that nobody even knows about in standard science, let alone describe something. Then I talk about biblical weather. So when the Bible talks about Noah's flood or the events going on when Moses was taking the Israelites out of Egypt, etc., biblical weather, some of the big events in human history were related to weather and the electrical nature of the solar system weather, etc. Then I talk about predicting the weather and storms, and then, of course, the chapter, Will Man Survive, in all of my books. Living with a star, can man survive in outer space? And so a very important chapter, because this really sets down the standard for people developing space programs. And then I talk about small, medium, and large comets. So distinguishing between the small, medium, and large. And Hale-Bopp would have been a medium comet. Even though it's a planet, it's Planet X, is larger than Earth, but still not a really big comet. that the solar system has seen historically. Then I breach the topic for the public of weather control. Now, this is before all of the modern weather control people jumping up and down and out there talking about HAARP and other things like that. This is a topic that shows what we developed when I worked with the Russians in the mid-1990s, and the fact that weather is controlled electrically, and the laser satellites, etc. So the future of weather control is tremendous. And by the way, these books, you know, even though this book is over 15 years old, it is still the primary topic, the primary source for understanding these topics. Then I talk, the very last chapter here, is the Russian weather work I did with Alexei Dmitriev, Alexander Tetanov, and the Russian scientists. So I go through that. There's a complete chapter there. And then also emails giving the exchange back and forth, just in a sample so that you get a feeling for what was going on. Then there's an appendix. The title, From Exodus to Voyager 2, The Velikovsky Connection. So that caps off this book. So once again, now this was going to be a 600-page book. I had to work tremendously to edit this book down to 50% of its size so that I could publish it. So 50% of the material had to be taken out. So there was a lot of data, a lot more discussion, a lot more theoretical work that just had to be removed so that the public could actually manage this book. The center of the book are 8 pages which have the entire surface area of Mars, satellite photography, high-resolution surface of Mars. So these are high-resolution prints that are printed separately on high-resolution paper in the center of the book, and we did that. But then, of course, the e-books are in color. All of the photographs, etc., in the e-books are in color, which makes them a little bit more desirable simply for that point of view. But some people like a hardcover book, and I do too. I grew up with them. I like them. And so the hardcover books are still available also. But anyway, the Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, a monumental book that just changed everything that the scientific community knew about the weather. I mean, the weather is, there's an expression that I coined back in the 90s. I said, you can't predict the weather if you don't know what causes the weather. And that's why the weatherman can predict the weather like 1 to 2 days out, because they have computer models. And what do? They take the data that's going on now, the atmospheric pressure, the wind, the temperature, whatever, all the data, and they put it in a computer model, and then it looks for historical times when things were similar, and then what did it do the next day and the next day after? And so they make some predictions like that, but they can get out 2 or 3 days and then make some sometimes, you know, accurate predictions and sometimes not. But the weatherman is making predictions based on faulty information. They don't know what causes the weather. And it turns out that the meteorologists that you'll see on TV or the cable channel, whatever, are they're text readers. They're like a pretty face they put on TV, and their job is to read. They're in a green room, and with a green screen, and the maps that are being shown, they don't even see them. They're reading from a teleprompter and moving their hand, etc. And a lot of times they don't even move their hand. They're just standing there talking, reading a teleprompter. So they have no idea about the weather. And they're not weathermen. They're weather readers. And their job is to read what's on the teleprompter. That's it. And there was an example. Here's a great example of a guy that went off script, because there was a hurricane that came into the Yucatan Peninsula. And so anyway, the hurricane died down very quickly. And the reason it did is because there's a big continental shelf off of the Yucatan Peninsula. And the hurricane had shorted out. It's a very shallow shelf. And if you've ever been there, I've been there many times personally. but also in the air over the area, and also from the maps you can see this, even if you don't go there. But anyway, the hurricane had shorted out and lost a lot of energy before it made landfall. So this weather guy with a skinny little tie is saying that this hurricane lost energy because of the big mountains in Yucatan. And I'm like, oh my God, Yucatan is the flattest pancake area in the world. There are no mountains. There are no hills. There are no undulating land even. It is flat as a pancake. There are no mountains there. But this was the weatherman going off script, telling you that those big mountains in the Yucatan stopped this storm. Oh my goodness. These people are simply clueless. Or how about the weatherman in Florida? There was a hurricane and it made a more than 90 degree right turn. It was a manipulated storm. And they brought in some just strange, bizarre weather terminology that didn't even make sense. So anyway, that what they're doing is covering for the manipulation that was going on. And just like, oh, yeah, that's normal. Just absolutely ridiculous. So the weathermen, you know, if you go to the Weather Channel or anything like that. And by the way, prior to me writing this book, I had access to very good data. After I wrote this book, all of the real good Weather Channel sources went under. They went away. And now all you get is like, okay, the temperature, the humidity, the wind speed. You know, you do not get any weather information. And a great example of this, there was a GOES West satellite that covers the west coast of the United States. It went down for reloading software for maintenance. And when they brought it back up, they didn't put in the filters. Somebody forgot to switch on the filters. What the filters do is they filters out all of the nefarious weather control things that are going on at the time, like the chemtrails and other weather manipulation. And so for a short period of time, the GOES West satellite showed what it really sees. And then they took it down very quickly, turned on the filters, and then brought it back up. And all the chemtrails were gone. All of the other activity, nefarious weather control activity, especially in California. It's really outrageous what they're doing to California in terms of weather control. And then people ask me also, is everything controlled now, all of the weather? And actually, no. Not all of the weather is controlled. Very little of it is controlled. And then now they're inventing new terms. For example, polar vortex is a new term that describes something that's been going on for centuries and thousands of years. It's a, when I was a kid, we called them Alberta Clippers because it was a wind that literally came from the North Pole, the Arctic Circle, down across Canada and into central, north central the United States. And now they have a special term for it, the polar vortex. But it's these storms have been going on for decades. So they create new terms to make it sound like the boogeyman and global warming is causing it, etc., when it's just standard weather. So the weather today and weather reporting is bizarro. That's all. That's the best thing you can say about it. And one last thing. I talked about the Hurricane Prediction Group. Professor Gray was the man who was in charge of that group for about 20 years. He founded the group at the University of Colorado in Boulder. That's where it was originated in making these predictions. And one day after this event in Florida that I talked about, he got up and he said, this is ridiculous, he said. And this is the guy that invented the whole scheme of predicting hurricanes for the National Weather Service. He said, none of this work that we've been doing has any merit at all. It doesn't have any meaning. It's completely bogus science. And he quit. And his right-hand man also quit with him because he knew that they were putting out false information. And if they were faulty on this prediction, then it would have potentially killed thousands and thousands of kids who are sitting in school as this hurricane made its way like landfall. But if you could imagine some of the historical big hurricanes in Florida's history, like what was Hurricane Andrew, I think was one of them, just devastating. Imagine that the hurricane made landfall and all these kids are in school. What chaos, what disaster, what a death toll. And so anyway, Professor Gray rightfully quit and walked away, but the program continued, and it still continues to this day. Now there's more and more universities making these ridiculous predictions based on, you know, the high-level wind shear and things that have absolutely nothing to do with hurricane prediction. Hurricanes are produced by the vertical electric field discharging to the cloud tops and then forming the eye, etc., and they are manipulated by enhancing that same electrical current using laser satellites. That's the work that I developed with the Russian scientists, that we took it to the U.S. military to develop so that they could drag hurricanes away from harm's way, and they used it to militarize hurricanes against population centers. So at any rate, the weather book, very important. Now, in the history of my discoveries and my work, etc., this is the point in history, 2004, where the CIA comes in and forms a group that borrows my terminology, borrows my work, and makes it into crazy work, and has Tom Van Flandern, who was, remember, the assistant at the Naval Observatory of Robert Harrington, who discovered Planet X. Now, Van Flandern, after Harrington died mysteriously in 1991, or may have been 1992, when Harrington actually died, a mysterious sudden death, Tom Van Flandern, who initiated the entire Planet X search, etc., becomes handler in 2004 of this group. And so the one thing that, as they're trying to lift my work and the electric universe term and all of this, you know, everything else, and to talk about electric comets and, you know, as if they were discovering something, and a lot of Velikovsky's work pretending they had discovered that. Basically, everything they did was steal from other people. But they got a lot of money under the table. So they had a YouTube channel, very spiffy graphics, very spiffy web page. They got a picture of the day. They had a person that worked at NASA who they supposedly opposed and were violently opposed to as fighting the good fight, etc. They had a guy at NASA who provided them with a picture of the day every day for years from NASA files with an explanation, because these bozos, none of them are scientists, none of them have any clue about what's going on in outer space, and pretending they have degrees that they don't have, pretending to be physicists when they have no physics degree at all, and getting a lot of money under the table, holding conferences, etc. And out of this grew the plethora of groups on the internet today claiming to be electric universe experts. Now, the electric universe is a term that I coined and used throughout all of my early work, etc. And of course, one could make a claim, let's take a term like relativity. When you hear of relativity, relativity is just an English word. It's been around for hundreds of years. But when you think of relativity in the science sense, you think of Albert Einstein. It's automatic. So when you hear the term electric universe, you would think James McCaney. And so it was important for the CIA, as they always do, to create disinformation. They create the controlled opposition. They control the opposite side. And this group, being nutcases, mental degenerates, and the fictitious characters, people who made up degrees that they don't have, they made up a society called the Galileo Galilei Society and started giving themselves gifts and awards back and forth I mean, just scammers. These people are scammers, but got a lot of support under the table. And a lot of that support comes in terms of private foundations, like, say, the Mainwaring Foundation, etc., which, you know, gets money and can put it under the table and fund people. So it makes them look very good. Put a glossy, it's like glossy lipstick on a pig, could make a pig look beautiful to some people, maybe other, you know, but that is the point. The entire point of coming in at this point was because I was making far too much headway with the public. And I was working on my own, of course. I never have been rich off of this. People used to criticize me for selling my books. Oh, he's just selling books to make money. When then other people would come back, my supporters, and say, hey, look, he's doing what you should be doing. He's selling his work. He's not, you know, and it's in the flying in the face of NASA and standard science. So they don't want you to make any money. But they get all their government money. They get billions of dollars a year from government funding. And the people's being supported by the CIA. So it's very important in history to understand that this is the point where they come in and start really cranking up the disinformation campaign, because they're... And the other point here is that they never, ever mention Planet X. Never. And the so-called support of Velikovsky, well, the whole Velikovsky story is about a Planet X object. It's a comet that becomes Planet Venus. What more Planet X type of topic could you have? But of course, there again, that's why they had to trounce Velikovsky, because he had hit the nail exactly right on the head. So this group takes over Velikovsky, uses his name to advance themselves, and then twists it and turns it into garbage once again. And then eventually washes Velikovsky out of the scene to where they're the great discoverers. And so anyway, what's interesting is when people would post in the blog, on the YouTube channel or whatever, my name, it would be immediately taken down, or my webpage or anything like that. So there never could be any reference to James McCanney. And of course, this is how early YouTube started censoring. So all of the modern, you know, the 2019, 2020 era, when there was a massive censoring on social media, etc., for political reasons, for other reasons, etc. But isn't it amazing that one group can say something and another group can say the same thing, but are completely obliterated out of the out of any recognition or any ability to voice anything or even ability to be recognized on the same medium. And so it's very important to understand, too, the time frame, because this is when also there were dozens of new Planet X, we're all going to die, people coming on the scene. And that's what I said. I collected all these books. And so, and when you look at them, they're all published at the same publishing house, and they all have a big orange ball on the cover. And that's what the CIA, and remember, you're saying, oh, the CIA, they're an intelligence agency. No, they have nothing to do with intelligence. They gather information on you, the public, because their job is to maintain the banking system. That's what their job is. And so they do that also through military, support of the military-industrial complex to keep international wars going. That's their job, chaos. And, of course, the biggest thing for control of the public, you have the big three religions, which are controlled. By the way, the Jesuits have taken over all of the American universities and colleges. It's just, you know, rampant. And of course, putting in their philosophies and hiring professors, etc. And that's why you find students coming out of universities that don't know a thing. They have no clue. They don't know anything about their history. They don't know anything about the human race. And when I taught in a university level back, that was in the kind of the earlier 90s, when I was gainfully unemployed, so I went back to university teaching for a couple of years. The students still had a little bit of an idea of what was going on, but it had already washed to the point where the college education really did not contain that much valuable information. had a lot of misinformation already in place. And so there was an era when there was a lot of misinformation. That is when, by the way, the Mayan calendar, remember the Mayan calendar, 2012, December 31st, there's going to be the end of the world because this magical date of the end of the Mayan calendar, supposedly 4,000 years old, totally fabricated. Just like the, remember the millennium bug of where all of the computers were going to die and between December 31st, 1999 and January 1st, 2000, all the computers in the world were going to die and it would be the end of the world and we're all going to die. Oh my goodness. You know, and so now in the year 2004, that's when the big push of, and they tried to incorporate the Colbrin in this, that somehow the Colbrin predicted the end of the world, etc. So absolutely insanity, disinformation, radio shows filled with this nonsense. And my radio show, if you go back and listen, will be have a lot of information dissuading you from believing any of this garbage that's out there. In fact, I've spent half of my career deflecting this garbage, and then they try and include me in it, like I'm some kind of predictor. They even went to the point of taking some of my early radio shows, cutting and pasting them and making it sound like I was predicting that Planet X was going to come in soon and we're all going to die. And that video still gets tossed around back into the loop every now and then, saying Professor McCanny is predicting Planet X very soon. And it's a composite of my voice from my radio shows. And one of my fans went back into that time frame, that early 2000s, and he found the radio shows where they clipped my voice and put it all together in pieces to make this one collage. A fan of mine did that, and he identified all the different shows and the different parts of my show where they clipped that, and then put some kind of a front cover on and made a YouTube video. So they were actually posting, and that's why on my webpage I say, I don't post on YouTube videos because it's just a big cauldron of disinformation. And any real information there will be simply lost in the sea of garbage and misinformation and wannabes, etc. Now, this brings up the question of peer review. On my webpage, I have a subpage that's called Critique of Peer Review. And peer review is the opposite side of the two-edged sword. If you open it up to anybody in the general public, then you end up having a problem because everybody thinks they're an expert. People have no training of any kind. It's kind of like if you said, okay, everybody can fix my car. Everybody can come in and, you know, change this and put other things on it and it would be just a big mess. So you have people who are trained in the field of fixing your specific car so that they can do it properly, etc. Okay, well, that's great. But then the opposite side of that is that the peer-reviewed system has become cloistered. And only people with degrees living in universities in the ivory tower system can publish in the peer-reviewed journals. So as I give the top 10 reasons and then plus some other reasons why I don't publish in peer-reviewed journals. But I have. I have published in serious astrophysics peer-reviewed journals. And as I said, I eventually got blackballed because I opposed the standard fare. And the people were so outraged, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know that what I was doing was 100% correct and what they were depending on, sitting on their laurels of theories that were, you know, ancient and certainly were proposed before the space program even existed, that the peer review system is broken because it only allows you to add to what's there and there's no way to challenge what's there. There are Nobel Prizes given for incorrect information. And once that's in place, everybody cheers and everybody's got to go that direction. And their paychecks depend on it, and that's the worst part. Their paychecks depend on it, and that is why when you do what you look at what I'm doing, sure, I sell my books, but really, most of them have been stolen and sideswiped and printed on Amazon, etc., so that I don't make any money off of them. But the point is that I'm not dependent on a government grant. That's not where I get my living from. I don't depend on Carl Sagan approving of my material, even though he's dead, but his followers or whoever. Peer review is dead, and the one thing I say is that, for example, if there is innovative work, why would you submit innovative work to a journal in a field where the people that are so-called experts are going to be judging it, and they're going to do one of two things. They're going to kick it out and pretend it doesn't exist because it contradicts their peer-reviewed work, which has been published, or they're going to steal it, which is, there's one of two possibilities, and neither one of them are valid. Neither one of them are scientific. They're based on the professor syndrome. The professor syndrome is actually a chemical. This is a psychological reality. They have discovered an enzyme that is produced in the body, and it's they call it the professor enzyme or the professor syndrome, that when the mind gets something that's contradictory to its belief system, it automatically throws up a door. And there's a great old show. It's on, was Archie Bunker, All in the Family, was when I was a kid. There's still episodes you can see on YouTube, but it's the conflict between young and old opinions, etc. The working class versus the young college kid who's never held a job. You know, and on and on and on. And, you know, the way they theorize about how the world works, but have no real world experience, etc. And that's going on today as you see some of the people coming out of universities. They've never held a job. They don't have any reality check in the real world. They've never been to a third world country, except for maybe Cancun five-star hotel in Mexico. You know, they have no knowledge of anything in the world, yet they claim to be experts because they went to college. And so the end result is, thinking about peer review and the structure of science today is it just does not allow for any variability. And when Michael Muma, who is a Goddard the Goddard Space Flight Center, he's a scientist there, head of a group, came up to me at the American Geophysical Union with about 15 grad students behind him, all standing off at a distance, and he confronts me. He says, "You can't be doing this. What are you doing?" You know, and I have a sign that says, "Comets are not dirty snowballs," and the graduate students are standing there aghast. Someone is, defaming their hallowed ground. And here's their leader, their fearless leader, approaching me and giving me crap. And I told him off in front of him. And I said, get out of here. They're very mad. But that's their attitude, that you can't do this. You can't say that. You can't oppose us. And at this point in this lecture series, it's very important to understand the absolute venom that comes out. Then they turn into personal attacks. They go in and sideswipe, try to steal your material. They use social media to promote people and then downplay other people, promote people who are stealing basically my work and changing the names and the end results and then adding all kinds of things like the planets are all flying around the sky with electrical forces, when they don't understand plasma physics at all. And the one thing you can always tell is that when they use over and over pat phrases, that, the electric universe solves everything, but they don't have any science. There's no science. They don't talk about anything. And then, then we have an electric sun magically pops out of nowhere. And that solves all the problems. But then, once again, there's no theoretical work. There's no understanding. There's no projection of idea because they're quacks. And that's the symbol of a quack. Yet they fool a lot of people. Now, I'm going to skip over the Calculate Primes book because it's a very different book. It's talking about mathematics, mathematical discovery, and I'll come back to that after I talk about the Diamond Principle, because the Diamond Principle book is the culmination of all the previous books. In fact, it includes the Calculate Primes book. I'll just mention Calculate Primes here is the book that presents my discovery of calculating directly prime numbers. And then there are other books that followed back in the, you know, in the 2015 era and beyond. There's some other prime number books that came out as subsequent books. But the Calculate Primes is simply showing how to calculate prime numbers, but it does something else. It talks about diamonds, it talks about snowflakes, and it talks about DNA, in that these are more complicated systems of nature, and that they all have a basic rhythm and rhyme to them, and that the part of the Diamond Principle that comes in here is that if you discover, this is the opening statement, in fact, from the Diamond Principle book, is that if you find a diamond on Earth, say you discover a diamond and you find its properties and you learn how to crack the fissures, etc., and make this beautiful diamond, then it has all of these facets and internal reflections and impurities in the middle or fractures in the middle that give that diamond a very specific characteristic. Then what's your thought? Is this the only diamond in the world, in the universe, or are there more? Well, of course, if you had half a brain, you would say, well, there's more. There's got to be a lot more. And if you went to the far side of the universe, you would find more diamonds, and it would be using the same process to create these diamonds, whatever that is. And of course, there again, modern science says that diamonds are formed under high pressure and deep in the ground, and they come up during volcanic venting. It's absolutely absurd. How can a diamond be pressurized from softer material? How can a softer material pressurize a material and make it harder? It's ridiculous. Absolutely absurd. And how did all of this carbon become organized into this small little droplet area, et cetera, et cetera? So it doesn't make any sense at all. But that's the theory that's presented for the formation of diamonds. Okay, so the Diamond Principle talks about the human race, and is the human race ready for spacefaring and existence? And the ultimate answer is no. The human race is nowhere near. So people are, let's go to Mars. They're building equipment. They're doing all kinds of stuff. But the one biggest part and aspect of this whole thing is they're not ready psychologically. The human race is not ready to go into outer space. And as I've said before, say you're going to send 10 people. You're probably not going to send 3 like an Apollo program trying to go to the moon. You're probably going to send quite a few because you're going to need some serious support. This is going to be years in space without any contact with Earth, without any support of any kind. And so given these, you know, say 10 people or 15 or 20, whatever they're going to send to Mars, there's a psychological issue here, and nobody has ever done this, even in low Earth orbit. And there's kind of a comfort factor of seeing the Earth right there every day. Oh, there's Earth. And if I really wanted to, I could just say, I want to leave here and go back down there. And of course, you wouldn't, because you're in a program and you've been selected and, you know, all the responsibility or, you know, but maybe it has happened. I don't know. Where people just go, hey, I'm done with this. Get me out of here. You know, maybe it's happened. They don't talk about it. But in general, I imagine those people are well-trained, you know, just like Navy pilots or anything else. They're made to do a job and they're serious and they do it. But going to Mars, there's no door to go out and take a nice hike. You're in that spacecraft for years and then years trying to get back to Earth. And this is the thing I talk about in the Diamond Principle, that the idea of going into space is to have large space stations. And we can start out doing this in low Earth orbit. And then eventually spirit them away. And now so I have a propulsion system designed specifically for that. Moving the space stations using the natural local electric batteries around Earth. But let me just put it this way again. I could list 10 major issues, and I have done this. I've done this on radio shows where I've listed 10 major issues that have never been overcome in low Earth orbit that would have to be commonplace if you were going to Mars. Let's look at batteries, battery lifetime, battery replacement. How about radiation? Radiation in low Earth orbit, you're very protected. There's no radiation issue. In outer space and free outer space, what if one of these people starts getting sick? Or what if all of them start getting sick? There's no way to get medical treatment. You can't bring all of the medical paraphernalia that you might have to use. On Earth, you have hospitals. You can come back. There was a project at the South Pole one time where you had a whole bunch of PhDs and doctors at the South Pole, and they all started getting cancer, and it was because there was a major solar storm. The radiation came down, and it's the same kind of radiation that you encounter in the Van Allen belts. But they had to fly in the middle of the Antarctic winter and get these people out as they were all dying and growing big tumors, etc. And there again, there's no rescue boat that's going to go out and get these people coming back from Mars. So literally, it's something that nobody has ever done before in low Earth orbit. And then I could list 100 things that have never been accomplished for that period of time without some kind of replacement or maintenance or something else requiring you to be near Earth. And when you're on Mars, so you're not looking out the window. Earth is going to look like a little teeny dot out there some of the time, and the rest of the time it's going to be just really small. Like we see Mars up in the sky, this little red planet. Okay, well, I'm heading into the last minute of this particular program, so once again, I just remind you that these shows are brought to you commercial-free and using the only support I get for doing this is my webpages, jmccwaterfilters.com and jmccsci.com. And I encourage people to look at my education program. But the point about talking about these books is that this is the public display of my work, but for every sentence, for every paragraph, there are pages and volumes that I've worked on outside of this, on celestial mechanics and orbits and understanding a lot more. So the books that you see for the public are just a cursory introduction to my work. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.